from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out about a special quilting and fabric event that is part of this year's Spirit and Place Festival.
I'll chat with actor Nick Abiel about the off-Broadway play he created and is bringing back home to Indianapolis.
And I'll take a look at the National Geographic Sacred Journeys exhibit at the Children's Museum, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The 20th annual Spirit and Place Festival is centered on the theme of dream this year. Dozens of events throughout the city from November 6th through the 15th will encourage you to dream at the intersection of community, faith, and the arts. Sharon Gamble invited artists Lee Dunnington-Jones and Sherry McConnell to join her in the studio to talk about the inspiring art of quilting, piecing past and present. The event is Friday, November 13th from 5 to 9 at the Stutz Artist Center. Let's listen.
Before we get into the specifics of this Spirit and Place project, you both have relationships with fabric. I'm going to start with you, Sherry. How did you know fabric was going to be part of your world?
Fabric was always part of my world. Sewing, quilting, making our clothes, that was always a part of what we did. I grew up for my first 7 years in Kentucky, then my family lived down there after that. We moved to Indiana in 1968, and we made our own quilts, we made our clothes, we made our own pillows, we stuffed our own pillows, we slept on feather beds, we slept under quilts.
Wow.
It was always part of who I was. Never occurred to me that I wouldn't have a life involved with fabric.
Mm-hmm. And you're a third or fourth generation quilter, right?
I'm a third generation quilter, as far as I know. I know back to my grandmother that she quilted and sewed. In fact, when my oldest daughter was born, my mother came down to the house and brought me a pattern that had been cut out, a little black and white checked shirt. And I looked at it and I said, "Oh, Mother, that's really sweet. But you sure didn't have to do that." And she said, "I didn't. Your grandmother cut this out for you." So I made it up, and all of my children have worn it.
Aww.
And I still have it. And it every time I pull it out, it's a great memory for me that my grandmother did that. She was very, very special to me. She was very talented. She did all the womanly arts, crocheting. And she would do the most intricate filet crochet work. My grandfather would leave for work around 5 o'clock in the morning, and she'd sit at her dining room table very quietly and crochet.
Wow.
And you'd get up in the morning, and that was my memory of her, was sitting there crocheting. And then, of course, sewing and the quilting frame up in her bedroom in the wintertime. So, and my kids grew up with a quilting frame up in the house. I actually quilted for people for the first 20 years that I was a dedicated quilter.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a lot of fun. So it's always been a part of who I am. I was a model garment maker for Joann Fabrics. It helped me to get fabric for my children. My husband was laid off a lot from General Motors, so it helped.
Ah.
And I started making quilts. I actually have a diploma. I took a 2-semester quilt class at the Anderson Area Vocational School. Kathleen McClary, who was the curator of social history at the Indiana State Museum at the time,
mm-hmm.
came to Anderson and taught us to quilt. It cost $20. We had to save up. And at the end of it, we had a hand-pieced, hand-quilted quilt and a diploma.
Wow.
So I still have my diploma.
Although I bet your work speaks volumes more loudly than your diploma ever could.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. I certainly enjoy what I do. And I just recently had a quilt in the 19 Stars exhibit mm-hmm. that just closed at the Indiana State Museum.
Yeah.
That was fun to do. But it's also very intimidating to have your work up in such a public, awesome space for others to look at, because we never consider that we've done our best work.
Hmm.
We're always looking to improve and finding our mistakes.
Just like any artist.
That's absolutely right. Absolutely.
And people who heard Lee's name and may know of her as a jewelry artist, but you have a whole separate relationship with fabric.
I do. I also grew up with fabric, but my real passion with fabric and fiber and quilting and fiber arts came with a passion for antique clothing. So I started collecting antique clothing, and that led me into all kinds of needlework interests, women's history, political history. What were these women's lives like? I just started asking all these questions to myself and researching and trying to find the answers of, you know, what was the life of a woman who wore this dress? What was she like?
Mm-hmm.
Why did she save it?
That's beautiful. And it tells me a little bit about, I think it tells me a little bit about how you came up, you, that's a you plural, you two plus all of your partners in this project. So explain where the idea of the inspiring art of quilting, piecing past and present, where, how did this idea come up?
It came up because of me. I was asked to do this proposal, and I don't know why, but it immediately came to mind because of my passion with fabric and women and women's history and women's work. And so what I wanted to do was to show, to bring people together that wouldn't normally come to a quilt show, and to teach them something about quilters and quilting that they may not know,
mm-hmm.
which is really the thrust of Spirit and Place, is to bring people together that would ordinarily come together. So I envisioned a program where I engaged women who could tell the story. I didn't just need women who were proficient at their work.
Mm-hmm.
I needed people who could tell other people what they knew, who could bring quilts to the table, tell the story of the quilt, the techniques, how the techniques changed over the years, and how it related to society at the time. So all of this I built into the program, the proposal that I wrote, to do this in two cultures, the African-American tradition and the European tradition. So I've gotten speakers from all over three states that are talkers, storytellers.
Yeah.
And that was my biggest thrust. I did not want to just show people. I wanted to have people who were so well-versed in what they do that they could just engage anybody walking by and start telling them stories of women and fabric.
Including how the West was won with a needle and thread. I love that idea.
I love that, too. I haven't seen the program yet. Sherry has seen it. And my partner, Katie Clayton, with Quilters by the Stitch, has seen it. And that gal's coming from Illinois. And so she's going to tell the early history of fabrics with women coming from the East and the fabrics they brought with them and the uses they were put to and the importance of the fabrics and the reuse of the fabrics. And then Sherry is going to continue the story up through the present.
Hmm. So how did you go from a hands-on practitioner of quilting to getting interested in the history and learning about the history?
I've always been interested in the history of why things were the way they were.
Mm-hmm.
One of the catalysts was finding a quilt top among my mother's things after she passed away that had been my grandmother's. And it was not a quilt top that should have been a part of what my grandmother did. They used scrap fabrics. A lot of times they would go to the Salvation Army and buy pounds of clothing, mm-hmm. and cut pieces from there, make scrap quilts. But this was clearly the fabric had been purchased. We found it in her diary that this was fabric was purchased on the day they found out my grandfather had cancer. They stopped on the way home from the doctor, and she bought this fabric for her Solomon's Temple quilt top. And it went on through the time that he was sick. She did not finish it. It's a top with me. It was given to me. And in her diary, the day he died, it read, "My world ended today," and she never stitched another thing for the next 3 years. She passed away then. But I was interested to know, why hadn't I known that story? Why? What if I hadn't seen the diary? Mm-hmm. We didn't know for sure that was even her quilt top. But from that, I began to be interested in the Quilters Hall of Fame, went just as a person visiting the quilt show and the celebration they had each year. Then I was approached to become a member of the board of directors. I was doing some volunteer work. And one thing just led into another. And as I'm meeting more historians, I'm learning more. Where did this come from? Why did some families have amazing quilts that were never used? Why do some families have nothing left because they used them up, which would be my family? We used everything we made. It just became fascinating to me. And then I became a member of the board. And a lot of the people on the board are historians. And their stories were interesting and they're fun. The people are so much fun and they're so excited about what they do. Then that has led me to meet other people and to become interested in putting up exhibits. But to me, history is not just what happened in the 1700s, what happened in the 1800s, what happened in the 1900s. Certainly pivotal, certainly has everything to do with where we are today. But quilts that were made 10 years ago are now historic quilts because it was a particular genre. It was a particular fabric. It was a particular design. When you go to a quilt show now, you see everything under the sun. You see quilts that are clearly used every day. You see quilts that are only best quilts and will never be slept under, even as a best bed quilt will may never be slept under. Then you see art quilts that are made from found objects. They have interesting things on them.
What are some of the most unusual materials you've seen quilts made of?
I've seen quilts made from paper.
Ooh.
I've seen quilts made from canvas. I've seen quilts that have keys attached to them, and the key has a story. I've seen digital image quilts where the images are just all put together onto a quilt fabric, and then that quilt is quilted or embellished. There was a quilt one time that they'd actually torn the paper up, put it in a blender in a solution, and made paper mache quilt blocks, and pieced it together, and it hung in an exhibit. So there's all sorts of things. One quilt was a statement on our environment and had the, remember when the plastic six packs, the rings that go
those
around
rings,
them,
yeah.
was sewn to that
Ooh.
Over a picture of a river.
Ooh.
So quilts can be from anything. Barn quilts are now wood and they're painted in quilt blocks and they're hung on the front of barns or garages. I have one on the front of my garage. A quilt can be anything. Technically, a quilt is three layers, two layers of fabric and a layer of batting in between. But quilting, anything can be a quilted object in terms of the visual of it or the product of it or what's contained in it. So,
and you're giving a chance for visitors who come to this exhibit to try their hand and be a part of new history, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're always shocked. Excuse me. They're always shocked to see the different types of quilts that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
Most people will go up and immediately, I remember when my grandmother made quilts, or I remember when my aunt made quilts. Every family somehow has a story in quilts. We now have kids who've reached adulthood who perhaps received a quilt through Pregnancy Crisis Center when their mothers were pregnant,
mm-hmm.
or received a quilt through the Riley Hospital Program, received a quilt because their home burned down. We have all of those projects as well. We have photo quilts. My daughter April made a beautiful photo quilt for her husband's grandmother, who is suffering with Alzheimer's. The quilt hangs in her room. It has all the family pictures, and every day, they call her Granny Mabel, wakes up and points to each picture and names her family. And they really believe it has helped her hang on a little bit more.
Wow.
So there's quilts made for all of these reasons.
Sharon Gamble with artists Lee Dunnington-Jones and Sherry McConnell. Sherry is display coordinator of the Marie Webster House, the Quilters Hall of Fame. Lee and Sherry joined with a number of collaborators to create the Spirit in Place event, The Inspiring Art of Quilting, Piecing Past and Present. The event is Friday, November 13th from 5 to 9 at the Stutz Artist Center. The Spirit in Place Festival is centered on the theme of dream this year. Learn about the festival's dozens of events throughout the city from November 6th through the 15th at spiritandplace.org. That's Spirit, A-N-D, Place, spiritandplace.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Indianapolis audiences may remember actor Nick Abiel as a young man who was in many IRT shows, including A Christmas Carol. Well, Nick has grown up, moved on to New York, and has, with a few friends, created an off-Broadway show that has had three sold-out runs. The show is a fast-paced, very silly remake of the Jurassic Park movie called Hold On to Your Butts. Yep, that's really the name. Travis DiNicola spoke with Nick about the show, which he is bringing to the Indie Fringe.
Nick, welcome back to Indianapolis. Great to see you.
Hey, thank you. Good to be back.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to talk about this show that you've been doing in New York and bringing here to the Fringe, which is awesome. But before we jump into that, I want to go back a little bit because you've been busy. I mean, a lot of people remember you from, you know, when you were a kid doing IRT shows. You were in Christmas Carol a lot, right?
I was in Christmas Carol twice, okay. Yeah. But the first show that I did at IRT was To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah.
In 97.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was Dill, and I was, I think I was 10 years old. So that was my first kind of taste of the theater. So mm-hmm.
That's pretty, you know, actually, I remember when you were in that show. It was a great production.
Yeah.
Now, at that point, so you're 10 years old. Had you been, you know, been doing any acting in school? Was it something you'd taken classes in? Or, you know, how did you get into it at that
age? Yeah, I had taken some summer camps, and I had an elementary school teacher who suggested to my folks that I get into it. And so I mm-hmm. did some auditions here and there, but you know, hadn't really taken it too seriously until I did that show at the IRT. And, you know, it was all professional actors who were from New York and making a living doing this art form. And so it was my first kind of taste of...
You got the bug.
I got the bug. And I saw that you could actually do it as a as a career and not just as a fun thing to do. So I think that was instilled in me very early on. And so I don't know that, you know, when I was 10, I said, you know, so specifically like, okay, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
But it was a good start, and it set me on a path to kind of a realistic expectation of what the career would be.
And you continued to act at the IRT throughout high school?
Yeah, throughout high school. And then I went to college at the University of Evansville
mm-hmm.
On high recommendations from folks
at
the IRT.
Great theater program down there.
Great theater program. And so when I did a show right after graduation, and then I moved to New York, and I came back and got my equity card,
okay.
Which is the Actors Union,
mm-hmm.
Doing the play Holes by Lewis Sacker, based on the book. And then I actually came back this last year to do a play called Good People.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I've been very fortunate to come back several times to what feels like my home theater.
Let me ask about the equity card, because as you said, I mean, that's the Actors Union mm-hmm. that allows you to work professionally. Is there like an age where you can get that? I mean, or
no.
Was that, you know, or could you have gotten it earlier when you were younger?
I could have gotten earlier when I was younger. Yeah, I actually did a show, did the Red Badge of Courage when I was in high school, and I got like a special pass, like a one-time pass mm-hmm. from Equity that I was able to be. I was actually on an Equity contract then, but the deal was that
so able to be paid, but
able to be paid Equity rates and things. But I wasn't in the union. But
you
know, with the stipulation that if I did another show where I was under an Equity contract, I would have to join the union. So no, there's no specific age or mm-hmm. and you know, there's no really right or wrong time to join. It really just depends on the person. So
yeah, very cool. Mm-hmm. So you moved to New York,
yeah.
And you've been working there. And amongst the mm-hmm. things you've been doing there is creating this show at I love the name of the theater, The Pit.
The Pit, yeah, the People's Improv Theater. Which I didn't really have any connection to The Pit prior to this show. It's one of the there's two or three big improv comedy theaters in mm-hmm. New York. And so, I have done a lot of self-producing in New York. You really have to make your own to make your own way.
So with other shows, like
and, with other shows, mm-hmm. sure, yeah, other companies, and mm-hmm. And so a friend of mine, Kristen McCarthy Parker, who directed this show. She and I had collaborated on a couple of things, and we'd done some, you know, we'd done some projects that we felt really proud of, but that nobody really, you know, people came, our friends came, but, you know, the wider community didn't really care or, you know. And so we, about a year, almost 2 years ago now, we were like, okay, we just want to do something that's fun. Mm-hmm. That's our only goal, is just to do something that's fun and goofy. And so we started talking about doing a parody of something, and Jurassic Park is my favorite movie, and I could pretty much do it from memory, on a dare or whatever. And so we started talking about more seriously about, okay, well, you know, that would be fun. Let's do that.
A parody
of Jurassic Park.
And now, so before we get into that, so while you're doing this, are you waiting tables? Are you?
Yeah, I've done my fair uh-huh. share of catering, okay. And I do a lot of babysitting, and I'm a freelance babysitter. And so, I mean, doing all kinds of things and doing a lot of readings. You know, New York is a big new play development town.
Sure.
And so have done a fair amount of new play development with lots of different companies, and some of those lead to, you know, other things, other readings, and some of them are just kind of one-off things. And
so you're doing that, and you decide to start working on this parody of Jurassic Park, mm-hmm. so your favorite movie,
yeah,
right?
And we wanted to do one night was our goal, was our mm-hmm. plan. Let's just do one night. This is kind of a goof project. It'll be fun. Our friends will come see it, and then it'll be over. And we made it really fast. We made it in like 3 weeks with some, you know, intense rehearsals for 3 or 4 weeks. And we put it up for one night at a small 50-seat theater and mm-hmm. in a kind of a basement theater. Some friends saw it, and somebody who had a connection with the Pit saw it and said, you guys should really bring this to them. I think they would really dig it. And the Pit was looking to expand their programming at the time from just purely improv to mm-hmm. some more kind of theatrically comedic pieces. And so we hit them at a good time, I think. And so we decided to do 5 performances at the Pit last September. And we did that, and they all sold out. And
awesome.
And people on the last night, you know, somebody asked Kristen, the director, said, who are all these people that mm-hmm. are here at this show? And she said, I don't know. I don't know who these people are.
Great.
So, which is great. And that was
just your friends and family.
It had moved beyond just our friends and family. Which
now, the show is called Hold On To Your Butt. Is that
Hold On To Your Butts?
Okay,
yeah, which
okay.
is a line that Samuel L. Jackson mm-hmm. in the movie says several times. He's smokes a lot of cigarettes in the movie,
uh-huh.
and whenever anything, you know, intense happens, he says, "Hold on to your butts."
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to call it that, and a great kind of unintended consequence of that is on Facebook, when you invite people and they say that they're coming, it says Travis DiNicola is going to hold on to your butts.
Nice.
Which, you know, people are like, is it my butts or your butts? Whose butts am I holding on to? So we did 5 nights at the Pit last September, and it was very well received. And Time Out New York saw it and gave us a great review, and we were named one of the top 10 comedies of 2014.
Congratulations.
Which was huge. And mm-hmm. We came back to the Pit and did about 25 performances in March, April, and then we came back again, and we're in June, and we're currently in an extension of that run through the end of September for now.
And it keeps bringing in people.
And the word of mouth really continues to bring people in. So, it's fun. It is fun. I mean, I think that has really resonated with people.
Okay, so how do you do the dinosaurs?
it really is two guys, two idiots with mm-hmm. cardboard and, you know, an imagination. You know, we just act like dinosaurs. You know, I just take on the form of
I kind of wish that this wasn't radio for a moment so that people could see the move you just did.
Yeah.
There was sort of like this funky Tyrannosaurus.
Oh, yeah. Well, and the Tyrannosaurus has, you know, the two fingers, the thing, you know, real short, stubby arms. And so I won't give away too much, but we have, I wear like a bike helmet, and we have a traffic cone that I is strapped to a seatbelt that I put on my around my waist, so I have kind of a traffic cone tail. Uh-huh. You know, so it's a lot of, you know, found. It's all found objects, umbrellas, mm-hmm. and you know, some cardboard frames that we use to, you know, recreate some of the more iconic shots from the movie. And obviously, it's a pared down parody.
Sure.
So it's shortened quite a bit from the movie's about 2 hours and the show is about 55 minutes. So, mm-hmm. And so
timing's great too. I mean, with the new movie coming out this summer,
right?
You know, so people are kind of, you know, a lot of people are probably going back and rewatching the first
it's
one.
It's true, and you
so
know,
it keeps it fresh.
It keeps it fresh, and I've been surprised. You know, as we started working on this more and more, I've been surprised at how much the original movie is still in the zeitgeist. Is still really very popular, and you know, if you scroll through your Facebook feed, there's things about, you know, I was telling my dad there's a great little viral video about if Jurassic Park was set in different time periods. You know, mm-hmm. there's protoplasmic park and you know, so it really has not waned at all in the pop culture. It's still really.
No, and you've got your Jurassic Park T-shirt on with
that
iconic logo.
That's right. Yeah, and it, you know, for my generation, it was that movie. You know, mm-hmm. and that movie came at a time when. CGI had it was like the one of the first movies to use that technology, and so there's a lot of kind of meta commenting on in the movie about this new technology, and you know they're talking about a lot of the genetics and things, but it was also kind of a commentary on itself because they were using this new CGI video, you know, digital video technology, and so you know we parody that somewhat in the play because we're using cardboard and imagination. Mm-hmm. And so we say like, you know, wow, this new technology is amazing.
Nice.
Right. But it's a very lo-fi kind of experience. So
you're bringing the show here to Indianapolis and it's going to be at the Indie Fringe. Mm-hmm. And will it be all the original cast from New York or how
will,
are you doing
yeah.
that?
Yeah. Yeah. There's only three of us actually. So
okay.
it's me and another guy play all the,
so the whole cast,
the whole cast, yeah, all three of us. So it's just me and another guy.
And the tech
play
team
all the,
and
we're coming pretty light. So it's me and another guy and then a Foley artist, mm-hmm. Who's a gal who sits on the side
and a big semi truck with all your props.
Right. Yeah. We literally have, it is literally a box of props. She's the Foley artist sits on the side and makes, sound effects uh-huh. and has she has a lot of arrangement what am I trying to say, the a cappella arrangement training. She has a lot of background in that, and so she recorded layered her own voice into a lot of the soundtracks from the movie, and so she plays that and makes, you know, live sound effects and things to what we're doing, so it kind of elevates it from just two dummies running around pretending to be dinosaurs to, you know, two dummies running around pretending to be dinosaurs with music and sound effects. So so we found that adding her
the type
really,
of theater you can only see live on stage,
and that's, you know, and that's what I've really found that I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. In New York, like the type of theater that I'm interested in making is things that have to be live. You know, I think theater has struggled to figure out what we have to offer that is different than TV or film. And for me, that's what it comes back to is mm-hmm. is the live element, the thing that you can't recreate on video. Mm-hmm. I'm also in a mime theater company, which has informed a lot of kind of how we made the Jurassic Park play.
Okay.
But the mime stuff, you know, it relies on the audience's participation because there's nothing there. And so mm-hmm. you have to fill in, you know, what you're seeing with your own memories and, you know.
An imagination.
And
it's all about.
And I have found it to be a much more profound mm-hmm. experience than kind of giving the audience everything, spelling it all out for them.
Yeah.
I have been pleasantly surprised to find that people are hungry for that kind of experience. And I think that's what the Jurassic Park, this hold on to your butts, does, is it's that joy of, you know, of being playful. Mm-hmm. It's like kids playing. There was a review that we got that said, you know, this is like kids playing at the movie Jurassic Park, except mm-hmm. that it's adults who should know better, but don't, and we love that. You know,
that sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to see it. Yeah. Nick, great to have you back in town. Really appreciate you coming by our studios for Art of the Matter, and looking forward, when will you come back for the Fringe production of Hold On to Your Butts, and best of luck to you. Great to see you.
Great. Thank you so much.
Travis DiNicola with actor Nick Abiel. Nick's show, Hold On To Your Butts, will be at the Indie Fringe Theater from November 4th through the 8th for a limited run. You can get your tickets now before they go extinct at IndieFringe.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
What's your Twitter handle?
At mtravisd. Why do you ask, Sharon?
Because I heard that you might be doing something around this Saturday on Twitter.
Trick or tweet?
Trick or tweet. And we have other creative ideas for things that you might do on our calendar that we call
What Do We Boo? That's right. It's no longer trick or treat. It's give us good candy or we'll write mean things about you on social media.
That's right. Yes. I like it. Or trick or trunk, which is a disturbing trend.
That's an odd one. Okay. So, things coming up. Well, I'll tell you what I'm really excited about. It's something that I'm a part of next Tuesday night on the 3rd, November 3rd at the JCC. It's part of the Ann Katz Festival of Books.
Yeah.
And I'm moderating a discussion beginning at 7 p.m. with local authors Dan Wakefield, as well as Barb Shoup and Lou Harry and Jeff Knurk, the guy who's the cartoonist for The Jumble. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be talking about indie rights books as well as the local literary scene in Indianapolis. And that is, again, at 7 o'clock on Tuesday, the 3rd at the JCC, part of Ann Katz Festival of Books. And we'd love to have you there. It's going to be a great event.
That's right. And go online and check out all the fabulous Ann Katz
Festival
of Books events. There's a talk by the woman who brought yoga to the United States.
Really,
Tess Gerritsen, the writer behind Rizzolian Isles, is in town to talk about her newest novel, which is not a Rizzolian Isles novel, but it was still pretty fabulous. There's food-related events,
mm-hmm.
and just something for everybody.
Very cool event.
I love it, indeed. Yes. Hey, the day after Halloween is celebrated as Dia de los Muertos in many circles, including among the singers of Encore Vocal Arts, who are starting their season with a concert of the same name this Sunday at 5 o'clock at the Indiana State Museum. You can come at 4 o'clock for sugar skull making, calaveras, face painting, mariachi band, as well as cervezas and cocktails, something for the grown-ups. And then the concert's at 5 and has all sorts of music commemorating not only the Day of the Dead, but also songs about celebrating life.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Well, if you've never been to Irvington for Halloween, then maybe this is the year. They do a huge parade and a huge festival, and it's a ton of fun, of course, taking place on Saturday, the 31st, which is Halloween. But if you need a little break from that or you're looking for something a little bit different, you might want to pop your head into Book Mamas, which is that great little bookstore in Irvington. They are having authors all day long. From noon to 1, they're having Kate Piscopo, and she's got a collection of stories about the Irvington Halloween Festival. And then Ed Wank is going to be there from noon to 4 with his book Hoosier Killers. It's an overview of 30 murders from the Fall Creek Massacre in 1824, which I never even heard about, to some more recent ones as well, Hoosier Killers. And then Dwight Ritter is going to be there from 2 to 4 with the book Growing Up White. So that's all going on at Book Mamas between noon and 4, which will be great as part of the Halloween festival. Also, you might want to mark your calendar because on Monday the 2nd at 6:30, James Alexander Tom is going to be there for the book launch of his new novel, Fire in the Water, a story about the Sultana paddlewheel steamboat tragedy during the Civil War. And I'm going to have James Alexander Tom here on Art of the Matter in a couple weeks to talk about
great.
That book.
Can't wait to hear that. He's such a fascinating guy.
Yes, he
does a lot of interesting research before he sets out to write. Hey, the repertoire still hasn't been announced, but you know it's Garrick Olson playing this Sunday at 3 o'clock at 3:30 at Indiana Landmarks Center on a Steinway 9-foot D. So you know it's going to be a fabulous concert, whatever he plays. Remember, Garrick Olson is coming not one, not two, but three times to our city this season. A solo piano concert this Sunday, and he's coming back in late winter to play chamber music with ISO musicians at Indiana Landmarks Center, and then he's going to be with the ISO next spring. So lots of chances to get to know Garrick Olson.
Very cool. Hey, IMOCA, Indianapolis Museum of Contemporary Art, is working with artist Jenny Kendler on a couple really interesting projects that you can be a part of. One is she's asking people for 1 hour to look through the lens of a camera where you can only see sky. You can lie on your back or however it is comfortable for you. But whenever you see a bird pass, you're supposed to take a picture of it. And then to become part of this project, she's doing 1 hour of birds. You can send your unlayered, unedited photographs of 1 hour of birds to her through iMocha. You get more information at the iMocha website. But then also, this is really cool, she wants to find out basically what her own weight in feathers is, and you can help this by finding any feathers that you find in your walks when you're out tree peeping or leaf peeping or whatever. You can collect the feathers and send them in a bag and bring them to iMocha for her exhibit as well. So collect pictures of birds and actual feathers. You can find out more at iMocha.
I was so afraid there was going to be a drinking game involved. When you saw a bird pass, you were supposed to drink from the coffee cup or something.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. Hey, if you're hearing us Thursday night, if you're hearing us Saturday morning, you missed two fabulous things. But if you're hearing us Thursday night, call and see if you can still score a ticket for the ISO's Haunted Hilbert, a Halloween masquerade.
Whoa.
Very good. From 7 to midnight this Friday night, the day before Halloween. Actually, two more things that you might want to see if you can do this Friday night. Silent Halloween at Silent Halloween. That's your birds influenced me. Silent Halloween at Indiana Landmarks Center. Phantom of the Opera is the silent film this year. Organ accompaniment by Mark Herman. And then Comedy Sports Late Night Show Monster Mashup Musical at 10 o'clock this Friday night. That's the last performance. So great pre-Halloween things to do.
Ooh, that sounds like lots of fun. So what are you dressing up as, Sharon?
You know, I haven't decided yet.
Mm.
You have ideas? Should I be a bird?
Maybe you should be a bird.
There's a whole
I'll
bird
take pictures
theme.
Of you and pluck a feather.
Okay.
Hey, Sharon, if people want to find out more about local arts events, they can always visit indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide website, or listen to us on that calendar we call
What'll We Boo?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
The Children's Museum's National Geographic Sacred Journeys exhibit is filled with art, artifacts, and experiences for both kids and adults. Sharon Gamble invited the Children's Museum Director of Collections, Chris Caron, and Public Relations Manager, Leslie Olson, to tell us all about it.
So I know that an exhibition like this requires a lot of planning. When did you first become aware that you were going to be able to get this exhibition at the Children's Museum?
Well, the museum first started talking about putting together an exhibition about religion about as much as 4 years ago and pulled together a number of national advisors and went to the Lilly Foundation and said, we're thinking about doing this. What do you think?
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were very understanding that it's a topic that some museums might be uncomfortable to even take on.
Sure.
And so that excited them all the more that the Children's Museum, with its reputation of taking on challenging topics like the Power of Children exhibition, where we talk about discrimination in children, that we might be able to sort of create a national model for how other museums might be able to do this. I got involved intensely as the project manager and curator about a year and a half ago.
Now, when you talk with colleagues, and because you've worked elsewhere and certainly as someone mature in your field, you have colleagues all over the place. When you say, oh, we're doing an exhibition about religion, world religions, at a children's museum, do they go like, oh, scary?
Well, the reactions vary, just like I think they do for our visitors.
Mm-hmm.
I think some sort of publicly oriented institutions, their anxiety level instantly goes up because they don't have the habit of talking about religion. I think most individuals maybe learn about religion and beliefs through their family or at Sunday school, or they don't talk about religion at all, or they only know what they know from negative news stories. And we really wanted to sort of create a different alternative to that, which was kind of a safe place that families with children could go to talk about what they believe and to talk about and learn about what their neighbors believe. And so we've had both the situation where professionals in our field would be a little nervous about it, and also now that the exhibition is open and has been getting very good evaluation from our visitors, they're calling us up and saying, how did you do that?
Mm-hmm.
And how can we do that at our own institution?
So take us back a ways. What were some of the ways you started framing this as you thought about it to remove some of that fear? And I imagine a lot of the fear is just, well, I know the faith tradition in which I was raised and maybe those of my neighbors, but halfway around the world, I'm confused. I don't know anything about that.
Absolutely. Well, we started a process of collaboration. We know how to preserve objects. We know how to present them and create wonderful immersive experiences, but we're not the experts on each tradition. So we work with national advisors who are academics, and we also pull together local community practitioners and ask them, what should we be saying about religion and what is unique in your religion that we need to be sensitive to? And so that really sort of gave us the specifics as well as the general approach. The general approach we ended up choosing was sacred journeys, mm-hmm. both the very real physical journey of going on a pilgrimage or visiting a sacred place and how you could learn about someone else's tradition that way. But also there's, of course, the spiritual journey that can happen personally or within someone's own home. And that became a great framework when we partnered with National Geographic on this exhibit, because that's what they're known for. They take those beautiful pictures and videos of stunning places that we all want to visit around the world. And so it was a great framework for us to use for this exhibition.
And I was shocked to learn through information about this exhibit that 330 million people take physical pilgrimages or sacred journeys a year.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a growing industry. And when you think about some of the large pilgrimage sites of different religions, the Kumbh Mela Festival in India, which happens every 3 years, which is a bathing in the Ganges River, that can attract 30 to 50 million people.
Wow.
Our Lady of Guadalupe can attract 10 to 20 million people a year. So these places that large numbers of people are going to. But then there's all those other experiences where people want to go to Europe and see the beautiful cathedrals, or they want to go on a pilgrimage trail in Ethiopia or in Thailand. And so it's a common experience for many people,
mm-hmm.
and a great way for us to expose people in Indianapolis to those traditions they may be familiar with and those traditions they may never have heard of.
And it's especially intriguing to me because we're taking kids and their families, of course, which means people of all ages are coming to experience the exhibition, but especially people still in single digits, a lot of their journeying has only happened electronically or digitally so far. So we're kind of, in addition to planting the seed of learning about other people's faiths and religious traditions, saying, it's okay to actually go somewhere, kind of giving permission.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think many of our visitors are very struck by the beauty of what we're presenting,
mm-hmm.
Not only in the photographs, but also in the artifacts and the art that's throughout the exhibition. They're exposed to many different cultural traditions of expressing belief through art, but then they're also exposed to that by getting to do it themselves. We have an interpretation program that looks at the dream paintings of the Aborigines from Australia.
Mm.
And we have another interpreter program that looks at music and how it expresses belief through traditions around the world. And then an opportunity to put together your own stained glass window.
Ooh.
So there are wonderful chances for families to work together with their children and to experience through all their senses how different people express their different traditions.
I want to come back to some of the artifacts and objects and photographs in a moment, but tell us about you've organized the exhibit around some children, some representative children. Tell us about those, and I believe there are five, right?
Sure. Well, religion is a topic that could be very difficult to access for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that the Children's Museum does well is to make things accessible not only for the kids, but for the parents and grandparents who brought them. And so we chose to do that by introducing you to a number of teenagers who are going on journeys themselves. And they represent sort of major religious traditions of the world, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism. And in the video that you see as you enter the exhibit, they're all running into each other at the airport. And they're excited to go, and they're telling you about where they're going and what they hope to get out of the experience. And then as we take you physically in the exhibit to these immersive experiences, the Hajj in Mecca, Jerusalem, which is sacred to many religions, Our Lady of Guadalupe, Bodh Gaya, which is the place where the Buddha achieved enlightenment in India, and then the Ganges River in India. Then you meet up with your guides again. They're the ones who are experiencing the ritual. We don't want to ask you to actually take part in a religious ritual that's not part of your tradition,
mm-hmm.
but you can accompany these people and experience it through their eyes. And then finally, at the end of the exhibit, we sort of hear what they got out of the trip, and then you also have a chance to reflect and to think about where you are on your journey.
So I know one of the cool things, I used to work at the Children's Museum years ago, and one of the cool things to do is to just stroll through the galleries and eavesdrop and kind of peek at how people are interacting with resources and maybe see how it's a little different than how you expected them to experience. What are some of the experiences you've had watching families or observing kids?
Well, we recognize that this is a very different experience from riding the carousel or going to see the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah.
And so we've been very pleased to see how both adults and children have invested themselves in this visit. Preliminarily, we're seeing that people are staying longer in this exhibit than they do in a lot of them, which is a good thing. When they choose to join in one of our scheduled programs, kids are very silent and attentive. And so I think for a lot of people, there's a sense of participation in this. I think we're also seeing a real sense of awe. There is something thrilling about having the opportunity to actually touch a block from the Western Wall in Jerusalem, of being in the presence of the Dead Sea Scrolls, of seeing an actual piece of the curtain that surrounds the Kaaba in Mecca. Mm. And to see all these in one gallery is really quite stirring for many people. And I think adults certainly feel that and have personal conversations with their children to explain what they're having an opportunity to experience.
Boy, you can't get a better outcome than that, you know?
Absolutely. If this is a conversation starter that opens up a two-way dialogue between a parent and a child, two children, a grandparent, sharing their experiences, and a child sharing, you know, who they know from school and why they take off for this holiday or why they wear what they do, then it's a success. It's opened communication, and it gives people a chance to maybe learn a little and then to go beyond that and learn more.
Sure, because you know they're not going to stop when they leave the museum.
I hope not. I hope it excites people both to see more of the world, to understand their neighbors. You know, information leads to understanding. Understanding leads to respect. And so our ultimate goal, if we can increase the respect that people have for the traditions of others, then we've done a great service for the community.
Do you have a favorite photograph among some of these great photos that are incorporated?
Oh, there are some stunning photographs that have been curated by National Geographic. One is very regal when you're looking into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre on the in Jerusalem, which is said to be where Jesus was crucified and buried. Hmm. And there's a Orthodox tradition there on Orthodox Easter that the priest goes and his candle is miraculously lit, and then he extends that flame out to all of the people who are in the church. So you see these hundreds and thousands of flames spreading. And at the same time, there are photographs that are very personal. Amid the millions of people bathing at the Ganges, to zero in on just one person who's taking part in this very personal act of walking down into the water, pouring water on their heads, and having this personal experience. So the photos can be deeply moving on both ends of this perspective, both the magnitude and also the individual experience.
Sharon Gamble with the Children's Museum's Director of Collections, Chris Caron, and Public Relations Manager, Leslie Olson. National Geographic Sacred Journeys features stunning photographs and videos, as well as sacred items from many faith traditions. The exhibit runs through February 21st, and you can learn more about it at childrensmuseum.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll sample a new book about Indiana wineries.
Mm, cheers. I'll get a preview of the Cat Video Festival at the IMA. Meow.
Mm. And I'll catch up with the Da Vinci Pursuit. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.